This is ABC Capricornia. On air and streaming now on the ABC Listen app. Now we're talking.
This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company today. This week is Farm Safety Week. There's been some pretty shocking statistics released this year. So far this year, 17 farmers have lost their lives in on-farm accidents, and a lot more have suffered some pretty serious injuries, and that is a lot of people. So Australian farmers are being urged to focus on staying safe this week using better communication. Tasmanian farmer and chair of Farm Safe Australia, Felicity Richards, explains more to Tony Briscoe.
Last year was just such a terrible year, with 72 deaths in 2024, which was the highest number in over 20 years. So we hope that others are treating this as an opportunity to do better, to honour the lives lost by trying to reduce the number of fatalities and indeed injuries on farms. But we still have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, even this year, the total so far in 6 months, 17 fatalities and 87 injuries, serious injuries.
The serious injuries is a real worry because it's just not moving. We're not seeing that number shift in any significant way. So while last year in fatalities on farm was a real spike, if we take an average, we were starting to see those number of fatalities go down, whereas injuries, it's not the case. We're seeing that sitting at that high number, and we would love to see those also reducing.
What do you attribute the rise of fatalities through side-by-sides to?
I can only hypothesise. Sometimes we can get ourselves into the idea that a piece of machinery is, or a piece of equipment is, inherently safe. And I wonder if perhaps when many people made a shift from quad bikes to side-by-sides, people simply felt safer and they, as a result, didn't follow those manufacturer's instructions, which are put on a helmet, put on a seatbelt. Without doing those things, we're really not utilising that machine in the safest possible way. The other thing I'd remind people is the first step in a risk assessment is always to see if you can eliminate the risk altogether. And sometimes that means guys parking at the gate and jumping out and going for a walk, because the terrain simply makes that machine inappropriate. So with side-by-sides, I'd just be saying it, nothing's inherently safe. Always look at what the recommended safety features are that you'd be using and put those things in place.
What's the message you'd like to see for farmers this week? What would you like them to think about every time they get up in the morning and start to prepare for the day's work?
We're all here because we've been given a second chance. I don't think there's any farmer out there, or indeed person who lives on a farm and often a visitor to a farm, who hasn't had a moment where their heart skipped a beat and they just think, oh, that was a bit close. And this year, our campaign, Second Chances, who knows how many you'll get, is asking people to stop when those things happen and learn from them, reflect on them, give them the attention they deserve, because they are lessons and we can use them to make sure that we don't have that, you know, heart skipping a beat moment with tragic or near tragic consequences.
Farmers work alone quite a bit out there, or all across the country. Inherently, that's dangerous in itself, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and we've seen some work around the country highlighting that. There was a call from, I think it was the Queensland Police Force, to increase the use of PLBs, personal locator beacons, simply to help reduce the time it took for them to find people when they were in need of critical assistance. Now, that's obviously not suitable for everyone, but I know even on our, you know, little, certainly relatively little compared to a Queensland property, farm here in the Tamar Valley, you know, it's very easy for someone to go out and do a job and you don't know exactly where they are. And if they were to get into some kind of difficulty, it could take time. So we're asking people to put strategies in place to address that. And that might be you just have a simple check-in, check-out method. It's about emphasising communication and awareness of people where they are. There's also so many different technologies, not just personal locator beacons, to help us keep track of where people are with a view to just making sure that if the worst happens, we're able to be there as quickly as possible and give them the support they need so that hopefully they get away with minimal injury and harm.
How many farmers out there do you know that take sickies?
What's a sickie? What's a sickie? I'm thinking, looking out at the weather today and thinking, yeah, no such thing as a sickie, but there is always the need to be looking at your environment and thinking, what is the appropriate task I can do today? And with wind gusts predicted to get up to 110 kilometres an hour, I'd be saying there's a fairly limited range today.
I was chair of FarmSafe Australia, Felicity Richards, talking to Toni Briscoe, and she also farms down in Tasmania. It's pretty good advice in there about staying safe. And details of the Second Chances campaign and the Safer Farms report can be found on farmsafe.org.au. Well, one man who knows what it's like to have a second chance is Queensland truckie David Scott. He was crushed by a 700-kilogram cow, an accident that put him in hospital and changed his life. This National Farm Safety Week, Mr. Scott is urging farmers and drivers to take safety seriously. And as he tells Brandon Long, this year's theme, Second Chances, Who Knows How Many You'll Get, is a powerful reminder to put safety first before it's too late.
Just a typical afternoon, I told a driver to go home and a birthday party with his young daughter, and I said I'd go out and load his cattle for him, one of the abattoirs in the city, and that's what we did. And so I tootled off out there, just a B-double load of cow. It was about this time of the year, and a beautiful big centre cows. Loaded the top pen of the B-double, then the ramp, obviously. Yes, they were fresh and they were feisty. Once we started on the pen on the bottom, there was one cow that just kept coming up as the mob and then going right back through to the back. Got the next pen on, got the middle pen on, then we're into the last pen. Well, she was the first one on into that last pen. And as she went into the crate, she just turned around and had her head half out the other door. The other nine cow walked straight in, and consequently she was not going to back off in there. I just had literally no way of stopping her coming back out the ramp. I couldn't get around to the side. There was just myself and a prompt, one of the owners of the cattle there loading, and he was down the back out of the road, I guess. And anyway, she just kept taking one step forward or taking one step back. And in hindsight, probably the worst thing I did, because I took another step backwards and she took another step forward. And as I turned to get up out of the road, my hip went into the middle post of the ramp, and the pair of us wedged there. And quite ironically, she just pulled back. I stood there, did the wiggle test, got myself up over the rail and down the other side, and collapsed and onto the ground I stayed, pretty much.
What was going through your mind at that stage?
Trying to see if I had any legs left, because I couldn't feel anything. That was what the problem was there. And anyway, I eventually clawed myself back up the side of the fence, and I was just literally hanging on there. That cow, ironically, had gone right back down through the triangular part of the yard into the yard. Consequently, this is where half the problem was. There was no gate at the top of the ramp, there was no gate at the bottom of the ramp, and there was no gate into a forcing yard as such. It was just one big yard up into the ramp. She literally turned around, went back on, and eventually got the big back sliding gate on the back of the trailer and kept her in there. And I was just hanging on the side of the loading ramp. There was a four-wheeler probably 10 yards over there, and I said, no, I'll be right, just let me sit down for a minute. Well, another couple of steps and down on the ground I went again.
You mentioned the sliding gate. So what was missing that could have made your job a lot safer?
What was missing, and this is probably where one of my biggest advocates at the moment is at the top of every loading ramp, as an animal goes on, and the day's gone by, a lot of people have just relied on purely the big back door and some of those trailers to either slide across or roll across or whatever. In the side loading instances, it's a matter of being quick and holding them with your hand and trying to get those little doors around and then chaining them and that sort of thing. What's being put in a lot of places now is just a simple little slide gate at the top of the ramp. So basically, once the animal goes past it, it's on the vehicle. Well, you can stop, you can talk, you can do what you like, but you've got full control of that animal. And things are easy to work from there. That simple slide gate would have saved me, probably a good 2 years, 3 years around the hospitals, and would have saved me a lot of operations, and probably would have saved me half my business, because we got rid of most of it because we thought we're never going to be back at it again.
That was Roma Livestock Transporter David Scott speaking with Brandon Long. I'll be bringing you more this Farm Safety Week, looking at solutions and also some of the information provided on side-by-sides and how to stay safer on them. So make sure you tune in each day from midday. It is 16 minutes past 12.
Before the sun rises, your local ABC team are starting their day getting ready to help you start yours. We're here to inform you as to what's happening with local news and events. ABC Breakfast, weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
I'm going to take you to the Burdekin now, where the cane crush is well underway, but there has been a few issues. Wilmar Sugar says there's been three incidents of people tampering with rail lines in the region this month. It happened about 2 weeks ago, and it resulted in two near hits and one derailment of parked cane bins. One of those near misses was found to be children switching the points near the Inkerman Mill on July 9th, while the other two incidents are still being investigated. Wilmar General Manager of Cane Supply and Operations, David Zeller, tells Brooke Tindall what happened.
So we've had a series of incidents in the Burdekin in the last week or so at our Inkerman, Invicta and Kalamia networks. And basically what happened was that the points have been set to the siding rather than the main line. And what happens there is when the loco comes through, instead of going on the main line, it gets diverted up into the siding. And potentially what that means is that the public's at risk and the infrastructure and the assets are at risk because the loco basically isn't meant to go up to into that siding.
Who is responsible for these track diversions?
So at this point, we're of the opinion that the members of the public, some young children on school holidays. So we did confirm at our Inkerman network that some children were playing with the points. And the loco driver called it in, and our logistics officers went out and spoke with the parents. And we've had an education process with the kids about the importance of leaving the points set. With the other two incidents on the Claimer and the Invicta line, we're not quite sure exactly yet, but we're still investigating that process.
And what kind of disruption does this cause?
We were lucky in two of the incidents that we were able to pull up before we actually had equipment damage or anyone got hurt. With one of the incidents, though, there was the loco did run into some parked bins and derail the bins. And what that means is then that the loco can't, it's not free to run up and down the line. We had to get the navvies out, re-rail the loco, re-rail the bins. So it causes disruption to our running time and our running schedules without... not taking into account injuries that may or may not happen.
And now this week is actually Farm Safety Week. What are some of those reminders of, being safe around, especially the cane train network?
So in terms of the actual cane network, particularly with the points and the kids that were throwing the points, this is not a bit of harmless fun. This can cause serious injury to, loco drivers, to haul out drivers, to members of the public, and also to equipment damage and infrastructure damage that holds us up when we want to be able to be going full bore with taking cane to the factory around those sort of things. So being Rural Safety Week, we want to make sure that people are aware of the trains crossing the main roads, the trains in and around the headlands. Make sure you look when you come outside your headlands to see if there is any trains coming. Make sure that you take notice of flashing lights. Make sure that you don't tamper with the points. All this goes a long way to making sure that we don't hurt anybody on our network.
How is the crush going in the Burdekin so far? Where are we at?
Yeah, so in the Burdekin at the moment, we're nearly at 30% completed of the estimated crop. The actual factory's gone better than what we have done in the last couple of years. Weather dependent, we would expect that we're going to have a good run going out for the rest of the year.
Wilmar Sugar, General Manager of Cane Supply and Operations, David Zeller, speaking to Brooke Tindall. It's 20 minutes past 12. Aussie beef may be dominating in the US, but what about lamb and goat meat? What are those opportunities? That's up next.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
A US meat scientist professor says there's growing opportunity for Australian premium red meat in the American market. So beef is definitely leading the charge, but United States diners are developing a taste for Australian lamb and even for goat. Dr. Mark Miller tells Cara Jeffrey there's ample room to expand Australia's share despite the 10% tariff.
Our demand for beef is going up logarithmically, and so we need to have as much high-quality beef from Australia as we can get, because Australia is the world leader in producing safe beef, and that's hard to get. You can get quality beef sometimes, but it doesn't meet the high-quality standards that you have here. And so the producers, the industry, the processors are absolutely the best on the planet at making beef.
And in the US, people still don't have a great taste in their mouth for lamb, maybe from the overhang of mutton that's been produced in the US. I was reading some literature that said 40% of US consumers haven't even tasted lamb. So do you think our lamb from Australia could find more of a place in the US?
Without a doubt. That statistic you just said of 40% that have never eaten lamb is an opportunity for growth. That tells you right there that that is very low-hanging fruit and an opportunity to really be able to logarithmically grow lamb consumption in the U.S. We've seen lamb consumption going up in the past few years, and we did a study with the Australians where we fed lamb consumers in the United States Australian lamb, and most of those consumers were beef consumers, like you were just talking about, and every one of them, high percentage of them, said that they really liked lamb and they would eat it if it was available.
Do you think, though, an issue with getting more Australian meat into the US will be that 10% tariff that President Donald Trump has placed on Australian meat?
I really don't. I think that the product that comes from Australia is economically already very much positioned to be in a place where U.S. consumers would buy it, because our meats are so much higher. So the price of U.S. beef is higher than Australian beef, and the lamb is also extremely high in the United States. So bringing in higher quality, better tasting lamb that also would be priced less in our retail store means the tariff probably has zero or no impact. It's not going to do anything but make the U.S. consumer pay 10% more. One of the biggest challenges we have are not tariffs or anything that we hear about in the media. It's truly being able to balance the price to stay consistent and not see these large swings where producers lose a lot of money for 2 or 3 years, then they have to go out of business, and then we have to get back in whenever the prices get really high. If we could have a more consistent price, which is what will happen when we have better trade and we can move that product out more frequently and keep those prices at a point where everybody makes profit all the time in every sector of the meat industry and the production industry.
And on menus in the US, are you typically seeing beef is the primary cut that would be there for your consumers in the US?
We do. And some of the things that we're seeing chefs really do, and it's helping the lamb consumption go up a lot, is pairing beef with lamb, because lamb is such a rich item that U.S. consumers are not used to that. And so when they get to about the third bite, it's kind of like eating that super rich chocolate dessert or something that you have, and you're just saying, okay, that's too much. But when you can pair it with a steak and have smaller portions of beef and a normal small portion of lamb, and consumers can trade back and forth that are not used to eating lamb, it's making a huge increase in consumption. So lamb, I think, is going to be a pairing. So we always pair it with wine, right? And I think that the pairings are going to occur between lamb and beef, and maybe lamb, beef, and some sausage, maybe, if we want to cheapen the price of the plate, because that's what's happening in our Brazilian steakhouses in the U.S. Most of that lamb consumption is going in those, the increase, because they come around and they feed you some sausage, you get some beef, you get some pork, and then you get some lamb, and they go, wow, this lamb is amazing. And it's because you're not only eating lamb. Where Australian consumers that are used to eating lamb only as the primary protein in a dish, that's okay. There's not as many of those in the U.S., so the way to grow it in the U.S. is to pair it with another protein that dilutes the richness of the lamb and the lamb flavor.
Goat meat in Australia, exports have been exploding the last few years. There's quite a lot of demand for it internationally. So what's the palate like for goat meat in the U.S.? Is it something you see on menus?
We are seeing more and more goat meat in menus, and this is the cool thing about lamb and goat, is that we're using it as an ingredient in making dishes that are normal. So it kind of goes back to what I was just describing. When you pair it with in a high quality restaurant where it's the only protein on the plate, we're seeing it really go and blow up in like fajitas, because fajitas are a component. They're a strip of meat that goes into a bread like a tortilla, and then it gets mixed with vegetables and some sauce, and so that lamb becomes a really good component. Goat does the same thing, and so that's why we're seeing a really need and a palate for that, is because it goes into a sexy dish that has a really good appeal because it's part of a experience.
Controversial question. What do you prefer to eat, Australian red meat or the U.S. products?
Well, I'd have to say I'm going to jump the fence and say both. One of the best steaks I've ever eaten in my life came out of Tasman, and it was an unbelievable grass-fed steak. And then some of the best beef I've ever eaten is American grain-fed. So it's sort of like wine. Beef is beef, but you can get different flavors of it. So it kind of depends on what you're feeling like, right?
That was Texas Tech University meat science professor Dr. Mark Miller speaking to Cara Jeffrey. Some pretty interesting points that he brought up there, especially around pairing meat, pairing beef and lamb, or even lamb and goat meat. I think it's a new take on surf and turf. It's turf and more turf. Can't say going to argue too much about that one, but Australia's sheep producers ready to capitalise on opportunities like the US market, because we're seeing right now that Australian beef producers are really taking advantage of the market over there. But industry body, Sheep Producers Australia, is trying to make sure producers are ready despite some of the current challenges they're facing. Chief Executive Bonnie Skinner has a vision on how the industry is going to look into the future. And she says despite the sheep flock in decline, there are many innovations and positives for the industry.
So my talk's really talking about the real challenges that we're facing as an industry at the moment. What we're seeing is a consistent move away from wool production to sort of more sheep meat type production enterprises, to an interest in feedlotting, to the boom bust pattern that we see in the industry, all the challenges, and of course goes without saying the dry conditions as well, but also what are the opportunities and how do we best position ourselves to take advantage of those opportunities. So our job is to make sure that we've not only got people staying in the industry, but that we're growing and that we're capitalising on the demand that we're seeing that's really strong around the world.
And obviously everyone knows the flock has been in decline since the 90s now and continues to decline. So you want to arrest that, but how do you do that?
Well, it's interesting when we talk about the decline, because this is an issue that Sheep Producers Australia has been really interested in for some time. So we saw them hit their lowest levels in about 2019. Numbers are down now, but they're nowhere near as low as they got to then, which was about 62 million head. You know, obviously we're much more productive than we ever have been. What's the optimum number that we want to be at? Because we saw, you know, as an industry rebuilding in earnest after the last major drought, and numbers, flock numbers are tipping up towards 75, 78 million head. Now that was followed, of course, by massive liquidation, prices crashing in 2023. And again, this is a really well-established pattern that we see in the industry. What can we do to help producers become more resilient to the changes that we see to prices, to the decisions that they make on farm, so that they're more resilient and that everyone in the supply chain is benefiting from better risk management?
And there is a lot of speculation about what happens as we come out of this drought in Victoria and South Australia and beyond. Obviously, there's been a massive sell-off of breeding sheep. A lot of people saying, do those people stay in sheep? Do they perhaps, if they do stay in sheep, maybe they switch from merinos to composites? Maybe they go out of sheep and into cattle? Or if they can grow crop in their area, maybe they go out of livestock entirely and go cropping? At the end of the day, farmers are just going to do whatever's most profitable, aren't they?
I was going to say profitability is the key there. And the thing is, in Australia, of course, not telling you how to suck eggs, but we farm producers in all sorts of different diverse geographies and climates all around the country. So, you know, we're seeing in some of the, for example, more merino-based traditional growing areas that there's a bit of a shift away from those systems to more shedding varieties of sheep. You know, we know now that the breeding flock comprises about 7% of shedding sheep. That's not going to work for all producers. It's about what works best in your area. So it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. But I know when we were talking about this in the 2019 period, we were having the conversations then about if we've got this opportunity to rebuild and fully acknowledge that it's going to be expensive for some people to do that, what, again, is the flock of the future that we're trying to build? What are the kind of genetics that people want to bring into their business and that they can afford to bring into their business? These are the kind of conversations that we've got to be having as an industry.
How about workload? Because if we look at the people here today and the sheep they've brought with them, a massive amount of work, physical work, has gone into breeding those animals. A bit different if you're growing crops, sitting on a tractor, not getting your hands dirty. How much of a factor is that? And we talked about profitability, but are people also saying, profitability aside, sheep are just too much work?
Yeah, that is definitely a prevailing narrative I hear from a lot of people. But I do also hear the opposite. I was just chatting to somebody yesterday who has run sheep for a long time and can't understand, you know, we're having this exact conversation, why are people talking so much about the labour costs when there's so many opportunities to improve your labour efficiency on farm? We've got handling equipment, things that can be implemented to make life easier. But sheep do have this reputation. I've joked in the past with other people about how do we make this industry more producer-friendly but also sexier as an option. You know, what's the Yellowstone of the sheep industry? But it is a real concern that people keep raising. And are they willing to make those investments? And are they looking at their business in a way that they can see that they're going to capitalise on those investments? They're key things to the discussion to me.
Right now, obviously, pricing even from mutton through to lamb is extraordinarily good. Longer term, what's your view on those global fundamentals and demand for Australian sheep and lamb?
We know very well that sheep industry, like many other commodities, has a boom-bust pattern. We knew prices were going to get very high this year. We were predicting that, and records are being smashed. We're hearing all about the lamb prices that are exceeding $400. I'm worried about what the cliff of that looks like, and some analysts are talking about that being in 2028. The thing that we've got going for us is that we've got strong demand globally. Now, what influences the boom-bust pattern is certainly when demand is affected, but also what happens environmentally on the supply side, which is our producers. So looking in the future, I think we can expect that we are going to see a big crash at some stage.
I read recently that Sheep Producers is getting into the retailing of ear tags, but not in Victoria.
The reality in Victoria, unfortunately, is that if you want to buy tags, you have to buy through the tag tender system that's operated through Agriculture Victoria. Now, I say unfortunately because that limits potentially some options for producers, but the reality is that tag tender has facilitated greater uptake of electronic IDs to support the rollout of EID in Victoria. Us entering the space is really as a reseller for leader products. We're one of many resellers around the country, and our biggest drive was trying to commit to our long-term objective of being able to provide producers with much more affordable tags, knowing that EID is rolling out across the country now. So what we're doing is providing producers with a direct online selling option, so that, purchasing option, so they can buy their tags at a competitive price and hopefully make the cost of transition more easy for them.
Sheep Producers Australia CEO Bonnie Skinner speaking to Angus Furley. And I'll get all the details on the weather with the Bureau of Meteorology up next.
Where else will you find free fun and games? Teens being boss. Hard quiz boiled by kids.
Oh.
And of course,
do not watch this show.
Find them all where it's always free, always fun for the family. ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
And it's time to check in on the weather, and Phelim Hanafy joins me now from the Weather Bureau. Good afternoon, Phelim.
Good afternoon indeed.
So what are the main drivers and watch points in the weather this week?
Yeah, indeed. The weather this week taking on a different flavour than we've seen in recent weeks. So it's going to be a lot milder, and it's also going to be a lot more unsettled. The first of that comes in during tomorrow. We'll have a weather system moving in across the interior. That's going to bring more widespread showers broadly across the interior. There's some cloud and showers extending into parts of the northern interior today as well, and also some showers in the southeast. But we'll see a trough move into the interior tomorrow. That's going to bring widespread showers through parts of the interior areas, you'd say from Longreach down to Charleville as well, seeing that shower activity. And could be some isolated thunderstorms as well with that. And then that system sweeps east and brings widespread showers to eastern parts of the state, more broadly, I should say, to eastern parts of the state come Wednesday. And that could generate some isolated storms around parts of the southeast and central Queensland as well. Could get some localised moderate falls out of it, out of some of that activity, particularly over the in the southeast as well, before it moves off the coast. The weather system does over later Wednesday and early on Thursday. And we see somewhat of a drier airflow following for a time as well, and the mornings cool off as well. I should add that with that system tomorrow, it does mean the mornings generally a lot less cold than recent days to the interior, but maybe tomorrow morning still cold, still some of that cold air lingering in parts of the northwest, but certainly for the rest of the week, less cold. And even with that little bit of a drier slot on Thursday, it shouldn't be as cold as what we've seen, you know, over the weekend and during last week.
Any major totals in any of these rain systems coming through this week?
Now, the first system during the middle of the week, it could generally broadly 5 to 10 mil through the interior with it as well. Maybe some pockets with some isolated storm activity in the southeast of maybe 20 or 30 mil, and perhaps over the central highlands of Coalfield as well during Wednesday. That system clears off, but it's more the second system that starts to come in later in the week, more like during Friday and particularly over the weekend. Now, that's linked to a pretty significant weather system, and that's weather system is going to generate a pretty large cloud band and sweep it across Queensland during the second half of Friday and over the weekend. And that could bring a widespread unseasonal rain event across much of the state as well. Widespread rain, you know, many areas could see 10 to 30 mil out of that band through the interior, which may not sound too much, but for some areas that's could be over a month's worth of rain, or well over a month's worth of rain for July through interior parts. And some areas of the south, and or I should say the southern half of the state, could see more than that out of that band as well. So many areas, you know, seeing some widespread rain from that system over the weekend. So probably in terms of weather this week, that second feature over the weekend, probably the main event in terms of rainfall and weather activity.
What is driving all this wet weather?
Now, it's driven by troughs and fronts moving across the southern states. There's one out over parts of central Australia, and that's going to, you know, move into parts of the interior as we go to tomorrow, and then the east come Wednesday. And it's linked to a low pressure system moving just south of SA and Victoria during today and tomorrow. But the next feature will be driven by a large low pressure system that spins up off the southern states and then moves east. And it's going to drag a pretty significant cloud band across much of the country as it does so later this week and over the weekend. And, you know, for Queensland though, it doesn't look like heavy rain this stage, but certainly moderate falls for many areas as well. So at this stage, the flood risk looks very low, but still a watch point with a significant system. And in fact, many areas across the southern and southeast states in line for some rainfall. For many areas here, particularly across the southern half, this rain will be viewed with a welcome relief.
So what about coastal waters? How are they going to be looking with all this sort of shower and potential storms and stuff about this week? Will they be a bit choppier, a bit more wind or anything like that?
In terms of coastal waters, no, the wind's generally a more moderate strength southeasterlies across the northern half of the state over the next few days as well. We may see the northerlies pick up about the southeast just ahead of the midweek system. And then again, with the system after that, it's probably more later as we go into the weekend and the actual main weather system itself moves across the state and then eventually off the east coast that we'll see probably a more general strengthening of the winds, particularly across the northern half and up around the northeast tropics.
And with all the rain about, does this mean less frost this week?
It does indeed, yeah. It still had some patchy frosts in parts of the northwest and southern interior today, but certainly less likely by tomorrow, but still cold, maybe some cool temps lingering in the northwest tomorrow, but certainly unlikely then from midweek as we get that that increase in cloud and moisture more broadly across the state. As mentioned, we'll see a little bit of a cooler conditions moving through for a time on Thursday, and before it warms up significantly again with ahead of the next system over the weekend. In fact, by Friday, data maxes particularly could be up to 10 degrees above average, with data maxes into the lower 30s across western Queensland before all that cloud and rain spreads across the state for the weekend. Now, behind that system then, we'll probably see a return to much cooler mornings with potential frosts as we head into the early days of next week.
And what about fog? Because last week was incredibly foggy. I know I drove to work a couple of days where I am in Rockhampton, and you could barely see in front of the car. Is that going to be continuing this week, or is the rain sort of going to keep that at bay?
Probably will be a watch point with the increase in rain as well, because oftentimes when the rain comes through, and if you've got light onshore winds as well, and rain as well, and those increased showers, it can lead to a lot of moisture on the ground. And certainly through the midweek period, fogs could be a watch point broadly about the east as we get that increase in moisture, but the winds remaining pretty light as well. So certainly a watch point for morning fogs about the east for the next few days, and particularly post the system. Once that system moves off the coast and we get somewhat of a cool airflow following during early Thursday morning, then we could end up with extensive fogs along much of the east post that system before the weather warms up again ahead of the next system for Friday and the weekend. So maybe fogs less likely then as we head into Friday and the weekend with the cloud band spreading across.
Phelim, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure as always.
Phelim Hanafy, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
We challenge you to step up and be a change maker.
The ABC is looking for trailblazers, 18 to 28, with a drive for making change in their regional communities.
Applications close August 3.
abc.net.au/trailblazers.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
North Queensland is experiencing a backpacker boom, with hostels booked out and pubs and restaurants overflowing with workers. But the same can't be said in outback Queensland, where businesses and graziers are struggling to find skilled short-term workers. Brooke Tyndall has this report.
Most afternoons, the beach volleyball nets on the strand in Townsville are bustling with backpackers enjoying the North Queensland winter. Hostels are fully booked and local hospitality venues are at capacity, with workers completing their 88 days of regional work for their second year visa extensions. Owner of the Australian Hotel in Townsville, Katie Kelleher, said she receives at least 5 resumes a day.
There's always been backpackers looking for work, but this year in particular, it's been next level.
In June 2021, a critical change happened. Tourism and hospitality businesses in northern or remote parts of the country were added to the approved industries list, meaning backpackers could head to cities like Townsville and work in a pub or on a dive boat instead of on a farm. 4 years on from this change, coastal towns are thriving with the influx of travellers. But northwest Queensland businesses and graziers are missing out. Robert Downey is the local publican at the Royal Hotel in Hughenden, about 400 kilometres west of Townsville. He says this change has left him with less experienced workers.
Those, we're losing a lot of those by going to Townsville, because you'd obviously much rather work in Townsville on the beach. So much more to do than, say, in Hughenden.
Julieta Blands from Argentina is doing her regional working requirement in Townsville so she can stay in Australia for a third year. She says the change to include hospitality in the 88-day regional work requirement attracted her to extend her stay in Australia.
Well, in my case, I wouldn't go to do a farm job, because I know I heard people and their experience wasn't really good.
But while backpackers clear out of northern Australia during the summer months, they flock to it in winter. Ms. Bland said it becomes harder to find work and accommodation at this time of year.
I think around March, April, everyone starts coming, and it is a little bit harder to get a job. You see, like, in October, November, everyone starts leaving. In December, there's no one. Like, the hostel was empty, I remember, last year. But yes, now the weather is beautiful.
President of peak cattle industry body Agforce Queensland, Shane McCarthy, says the short-term workforce has fundamentally changed since the COVID-19 pandemic.
There always seemed to be a good supply of young people willing and able to come out and have an outback experience while they're earning some money.
With less people going bush, it's putting extra strain on graziers who need short-term workers to help with farm work.
Yeah, you just have to either try and do it yourself, which can be a struggle, and sometimes, depending on the job, can be a bit dangerous. But either putting it off or until you can find somebody to help you.
He wants to see incentives to get workers out of the regional cities and into the bush.
Sometimes as a young person, I was exactly the same. You need a little prompting, I suppose, to be able to get out of that comfort zone, to go out and experience it. And once they get out there, we don't have usually trouble retaining them. It's just getting them there in the first place.
As backpackers fight for a place to work and live in regional cities, Robert Downey hopes more will venture to the outback.
I don't think they quite realise how good it can be out west. And the ones that actually do come out this way, take a bit of a leap, actually enjoy themselves a lot more than what they first imagined, or the experience is a lot different to what they thought initially.
He says accommodation is often provided for workers and people around town are keen to get to know visitors.
And we've actually had more stay longer because they enjoyed being here so much.
Hughenden publican Robert Downey ending that report by Brooke Tyndall.
A man's gone missing in the outback. But how do you search for someone who doesn't want to be found?
Death will come and I'll be ready for it.
Expanse, Series 5, Nowhere Man. Hear the podcast now on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
A national body tasked with financially backing new projects across Northern Australia wants to get more cash into the region. So the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility has been criticised in the past for failing to deliver money to the north. Well, NAIF CEO Craig Doyle tells Fiona Broom issues are being ironed out.
Look, for us, you know, we're obviously a financier, as you would know. I think for us is making sure anybody who wants to potentially invest or do a project in Northern Territory or Northern Australia, we're here. We're not a typical bank. We're not interested in profit margins. We're interested in public benefits and jobs and Indigenous outcomes. So, you know, we've been set up because we know how hard it is to fund projects in Northern Australia. So I think my message will be just a bit of a sell, particularly those international visitors who to know what we are. But also, you know, I think all the projects that we're involved here in Northern Territory or across Northern Australia now, Fiona, it's not going to take one party like NAIF or anyone else to solve the problems. It's going to be a collaborative effort of multiple financiers, multiple proponents. The government's got to play its role, federal and territory. So I think that's my message. It's not if it was easy that one party could do it, it would already be done. We've got to make sure we collaborate.
So would NAIF work with foreign investors, international investors?
Absolutely. I won't give you a percentage because I'll get it wrong, but I would say the majority of our projects have international investment on either the equity or the debt side, as well as Australian. So absolutely, we're very, very keen to make sure, you know, funding comes from multiple sources to de-risk the project, and that's great for the proponents. So absolutely.
The last project that was funded here in the Northern Territory by NAIF was the Nolans Bore project in January 2024. I think prior to that it was 2021, and then a few projects 2018, 2019, 2020. Have you got any big projects to announce while you're here in Darwin?
Oh, I'd love to, Fiona. All I'd say is stay tuned. There's a couple of projects deep into our investment process, so not to investment decision yet, and there's a couple in Northern Territory that hopefully next time I see you or you're here in the near term, hopefully we can announce some of those. So, look, we'd always like to do more. I mean, my message is we're not capped. We're agnostic in terms of the infrastructure we can fund. We've done some great projects here. I think I've got in my slide pack this afternoon, I think there's something like six or so projects in our pre-investment pipeline worth $420 million of loan value and $2 billion of projects are the ones that we just talked about that are coming through. And that's not everybody we're talking to. That's just the ones that are starting to get deep into our process. So stay tuned.
Not capped, as in you're not capped at a financial limit?
We're not really capped at a finance. We've got $7 billion total appropriation, of which we've committed $4.3 billion, so still $2.7 billion there. And I'd be pretty confident to say I might get in trouble, but if we end up lending $7 billion, I'm sure we'll get some more, because it means we must be investing in great projects across the north.
You are working across particular sectors, though. I understand agriculture, the energy spaces in particular.
Yeah, look, we're sector agnostic. I think I looked at it last night, to be honest, Fiona, and some of the sectors that we probably haven't been able to crack is digital, some of the cabling and digital, but we've got some data centre people starting to talk us across the north. Look, energy, we're already quite heavy in. We've done the Bachelor Solar Farm and the Hudson Creek Gas and Solar here. We've done some solar over in Western Australia, and we've got Australia's first pumped hydro project in 40 years coming online next year. It's our largest loan with $610 million in Queensland. So we're very keen on energy, and that doesn't have to be just the conventional solar, wind, pumped hydro. We're talking about batteries, and we've just started to talk to some people, not in the territory at the moment, around waste to energy type projects as well. So we're very agnostic about what type of projects we can look at.
And there was an independent review which was tabled a few months ago, or released to the Minister for Northern Australia a few months ago. It's, as I understand, not publicly available yet, but is NAIF functioning the way it should?
Oh, look, I'm probably a bit biased, but look, I think we've worked very hard in the last few years to make sure that we are, and I think one of those, and it's for other people's to judge, and I think the task force report, which I believe will be tabled shortly, hopefully that's very positive about what we're doing okay, but more importantly, what else we can do for the north. And that's what we're very keen to see and understand. I think, to give an idea, I think it took us, been around for about 8 years now, Fiona. I think it took us about 6 years, or just over 6 years, to put the first $1 billion of physical money out the door, which really, it's not until the money goes out that you see the benefits. In the last 3 years, we've been averaging $600 million a year out the door. So last year was about $550 million. So I think if you judge us on actually getting the money out, which means you get all those benefits, that's where we've really picked up and we're starting to do more. We're taking a higher risk appetite, which we're playing with public money, so we need to be careful on that. But, the board's been fantastic. We've just backed what I think is Australia's largest modular housing project in Queensland as well. So we're starting to play in accommodation space where we can. So, yeah, we're very, very keen to do more, and we can always do better.
NAIF's funding or operational period runs out in about a year. It's the 30th of June 2026. Still $2.3 billion, I think you said, left in the kitty. What happens over the next year, and what happens after mid-next year?
Yeah, well, that's the task force report that, as you rightfully said, I think it was the independent task force gave the report to the minister in February or March. Then this little thing called an election got in the way. So I think it's got to be tabled within the next 6 weeks, I think, under the legislation. Look, I think once that comes out, I think there'll be a lot of surety about what the task force has recommended. And then obviously we need to see the government's response. But I will say that, we've had great support from this government. Even though you mentioned Murray Watt 3 years ago, that same government's now popped us up from $5 to $7 billion a couple of years ago, named us in the Future Made in Australia, named us in the Critical Mineral Strategy. We're a heavy lender in the critical mineral rare earths, including Arafura, which you mentioned. So I think, we've turned them around on what we can do, and hopefully we're starting to do a better job, but more importantly, we can do even more for the north.
CEO of the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility speaking with Fiona Broome. It is 8:08, and I'm going to take you to New South Wales next, where a Queenslander has dominated in the 2025 Australian Working Cattle Dog Trials.
News, sport and talk ad-free. ABC Local Radio. Download the ABC Listen app and listen wherever you are.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
A four-year-old border collie from Monto in Queensland has taken out the 2025 Australian Working Cattle Dog Trials Championships. So the win topped off a pretty incredible weekend for 25-year-old Luke Aisthorpe and his team of dogs at the event in Casino. So on Saturday, Luke and his dog Jaffa won the sire shoot before helping Queensland secure the state of origin title over New South Wales. And then on Sunday, saw Luke and Jaffa's daughter Eva take home the National Opens title after a runoff. Kim Honan was there and spoke with him.
Congratulations, you've taken out the Open here at the Australian Cattle Dog Championships.
Yep, thank you.
And with your dog Eva?
Yes, Sticks Eva. So she's a four-year-old
tricoloured bitch that my dad actually bred. So her mother is Riverside Cindy, and then her father's Natal Jaffa. So yeah, her father won the sire shootout last night too. So, yeah.
So you've had a pretty good weekend.
Yeah. I definitely can't complain. Yeah, it's been pretty good. Well worth the drive down. So.
Yeah. How long did it take to get here?
Would have been about 8 hours, 8.5 hours. Probably a bit faster for some people, but I tend to do a bit of stuffing around while I'm driving. So,
yeah. And how many dogs did you bring?
I had 6 in the open, 7 in the novice, and 4 in the maiden. So, yeah. I had a few dogs for the weekend, so, yeah.
And to take out the sire shootout and the Australian Championships title, how does it make you feel?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Like, you're pretty happy just to do sort of well or make a final or be in the ribbons anywhere, really. And, yeah, it was pretty cool achievement to win 2 of them, so, yeah.
And you take home, an $11,000 cheque, the highest in the Australian titles history, I believe.
Yeah. It's really cool. I probably would have come down even if it was $100 prize money, but, yeah, the prize money definitely makes it worthwhile.
And is this your first national titles?
The first time I've won the Open, yeah. I was lucky enough to win the maiden last year at St. George. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. There's a fair few names on the shield that are, you know, pretty successful dog trialers, so it's pretty cool to be on there on that too.
And what does it take to, you know, breed and train Australia's top working dog?
A fair bit of time, I suppose, and patience. Like, she's hasn't been the easiest dog to train, and she's got a few years of age on her now. She's sort of matured up a little bit more. Yeah, and I just think she's a good practical dog, and she just was lucky enough that things went her way this weekend. So.
And to have to go back into the ring to fight it out with another competitor today.
Yeah, had a rerun, which I think at these sorts of events isn't always uncommon, you know, like the competition's always pretty tight, so, but yeah, it's a bit nerve-wracking, but it's pretty good competition at the end. So,
so how long have you been trialling for?
I did my first trial in, I think, 2021 with Jaffa. He was about 14 months old, and that was at Wallumbilla.
So very young in your career to take out the national titles.
Yeah. I don't know who the youngest person would be. I think maybe Isaac Potts. He would have been fairly young. But yeah.
And were you in the State of Origin team?
Yeah. I was in the State of Origin team with Jaffa. Yeah. So we were pretty lucky that Queensland had a pretty good win there last night. So yeah, it's been a pretty good weekend all around.
So you've had the trifecta.
Yeah. So to a certain degree, I suppose, yeah.
That was Luke Aisthorpe from Monto in the North Burnett region, the 2025 Australian Working Cattle Dog Trials Champion. Now, Queensland did dominate this year, but New South Wales did win some, shall we call them, consolation prizes? I'm not sure, but Clint Austin and his dog Duke took out both the maiden and novice titles, bringing a cheque and copper buckle home to New South Wales.
Yeah, he's just golly dog. Yeah, he's getting on a bit. He's 8 there now, so.
And how long have you been trialling him?
I've only been trialling for probably just on 2 years now. So, yeah, pretty happy with him. Yeah.
And is this the first time he's taken out one of the national titles?
Yeah. No, it's the first time, yeah.
And first time you've taken them out?
Yeah.
So you must be feeling pretty stoked then?
Yeah, no, it's good. I'm happy with it, yeah.
Well, how'd your weekend go overall? You've taken out the maiden and novice, but you had dogs in the open too?
Yeah, dogs in the open. Yeah, got them around, but they just weren't good enough to make the finals. And then I had that young dog, Rooster. He made it into the finals of the maiden and novice as well. But, yeah, just didn't get the scores with him to place, yeah.
Yeah, how many dogs did you bring?
Just 3. Yeah, just 3, yeah.
So what do you reckon it takes to breed Australia's sort of top working dog?
A bit of luck, I guess. Yeah, yep.
You reckon it was luck this weekend?
Yeah, good genetics, good dog. Yeah, there's a bit in it, but yeah. I was just lucky, yeah. Yep.
And you work these dogs back home?
Yeah, they get worked every day sort of thing, yeah. Bit of country down there, so Yeah.
Like, you run cattle or what do
yeah,
you do?
Yeah, we're on a block down there. We just run all breeders and we finish all our weaners off and that too. So, yeah, there's always a bit going on. They get used a bit. Yeah.
Clint Austin from New South Wales speaking to Kim Honan. That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. My name's Megan Hughes. News is coming up next. It's 1 o'clock.